For many Americans, whether you're an investor or a potential home buyer, the prices of housing seems astronomical. We are in a housing shortage. Interest rates remain higher than most people thought they were going to be, leaving many Americans feeling hopeless. Today, we are going to dig into what is happening on the policy level in regards to affordable housing. Hey, everyone, and welcome to On the Market. I'm your host, Dave Meyer. Today, we're going to be speaking to Dennis Cisce, who is the director of the J. Ronald Terwilliger Center for Housing Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. That is quite a title. Woo! And today, with Dennis, we're going to get into what is going on with affordable housing, how we got in this situation, what current public policy is, how that is evolving. And make sure to stick around to the end of the show because I'm going to talk to Dennis about how investors like you and me fit into the affordable housing puzzle. All right, let's bring on Dennis. Dennis Cisce, welcome to On the Market. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you, Dave.
Before we jump into your specific work about affordable housing, can you explain to us what the Bipartisan Policy Center is and what its mission is?
Sure. Thanks, Dave. The BPC, Bipartisan Policy Center, was created about 16 years ago by four former Senate majority leaders. Bob Dole, I used to work for him many, many moons ago, George Mitchell, Tom Daschle, and Howard Baker. And the mission is to be a place where people with strongly held political views can come together in a respectful manner and discuss and debate and try to develop, you know, policy solutions on a bipartisan basis that can move the country forward. And we have a number of different programs, including economic policy and energy and democracy and health, and I run the housing program here at BPC.
Thanks for that background, Dennis. Appreciate it. And it sounds like a really interesting role that you have there. Let's dive into the housing issues here. So first and foremost, how did you get involved with housing and specifically affordable housing?
Well, I was the Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. Back in the administration of George W. Bush. So around 2007, 2008, it was a tough time, obviously, for the housing industry. I also got to know over the years Ron Terwilliger. Now, Ron is the former CEO of Trammell Crow Residential. He has been responsible for building hundreds of thousands of apartments throughout the country during his career at Trammell Crow. I have done work with Ron over the years prior to being back here at BPC. And Ron made a donation to the BPC to create a center called the J. Ronald Terwilliger Center for Housing Policy. And our mission is to identify bipartisan policies that promote housing affordability, both on the rental side and on the home ownership side. So specifically to your question, it all started with HUD in the George W. Bush administration, back in the day, as they say.
So of all the different elements of housing that you could be focusing on, why is housing affordability your primary focus?
First of all, we believe that housing is foundational. The home, the house, your house obviously provides shelter, but it also is connected to so many other important things. It's connected to health. It's connected to opportunity. If your home is located in a neighborhood close to, say, transit or employment, that could impact your ability to move upward in society. So housing, we believe housing is so fundamentally important. It's foundational. But so many Americans today are struggling with housing costs. Over the past 4 years, home prices, for example, have risen by 28%. Now, the median value of a home is about $418,000. Rental prices in many communities have over the same period of time, you know, have skyrocketed. About 42 million Americans now pay about one-third of their income just on housing costs, and that leaves a lot less for other sort of essentials like health and education and nutritious food, for example. So housing affordability is incredibly important. You know, when I started working with Ron, we worked on a paper together called The Silent Crisis, and we were wondering, why aren't people in Congress or why isn't the media talking about housing affordability? This was about 10 years ago. And now things have really even gotten more severe since that period. And there's much more written, much more ink spilled about the housing affordability crisis. So it's no longer a silent crisis. And I have to say, you know, I'm a creature of Washington, D.C., I guess. And we use the word crisis a lot here in town. And it's one of the most overused words probably in Washington. But I do believe this housing affordability issue is really at crisis levels.
And what brought us to this crisis level, Dennis?
Well, we view the housing affordability situation through three lenses. The lack of supply. There's just a mismatch between the demand for housing and available supply. Second, the need to, you know, preserve the existing stock of affordable housing. And third, you know, there are just going to be some people whose incomes don't meet their housing costs and they need some demand side supports like vouchers. But much of our focus over the past couple of years has been on the supply side. I think there's broad bipartisan recognition that the root of the housing crisis is this lack of affordable supply. There have been various estimates put out. Freddie Mac says we've underbuilt housing by about 3.8 million homes over the past 15 or so years. Same with Up for Growth and other advocacy organization. The National Association of Realtors put out a paper a couple of years ago, said we had underbuilt housing by 5.5 million homes since the Great Recession. So it all kind of starts with the Great Recession, 2006, 2007, 2008. The home building industry was decimated. People left the industry, workers left the industry, and they still have tremendous problems recruiting and identifying skilled workers in the residential construction industry. So that's part of the problem. Another big piece of the problem is we've just have too many restrictive land use and zoning regulations that limit density and limit the types of diversity of housing that can be built in certain communities. So that's a big contributor of the problem. COVID struck, and then we had supply shortages and supply disruptions. And if you looked at the prices of things like timber and steel and copper, they went through the roof, and that still reverberates. And then, you know, with the rising interest rates, rising mortgage rates, now we have a new phenomenon, the lock-in effect. People with, you know, mortgage rates that are relatively low, you know, 3%, maybe even lower, just are not going to leave their house and sell their house and go to another home and get a mortgage at 7%. So there's been a lot of inventory that's been locked up as a result of the rising interest rates. So all these factors, Dave, in our view, have really contributed to the supply shortage over the past 15 or so years.
That's a great summary, and regular listeners of the podcast will probably recognize some of these topics that we talk about frequently as contributing to some of the housing market dynamics. So far, we've covered some of the reasons that we lack housing supply and affordable housing in the U.S., and when we come back, Dennis is going to discuss what is being done on the policy side to address it. Stick around. Buy low, sell high. Very easy to say, but not always so easy to do. For example, high interest rates are hurting the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices in a lot of markets are falling, even for many of the best assets. So it's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/pockets. Fundrise.com pockets. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that I turned one of my first homes into an Airbnb? It's true. And it even helped me get the extra income I needed to launch my real estate career. So if you want to try your hand at making even more income with your property, Airbnb is the place to be. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day, with Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
Welcome back to On the Market. Dennis, I'm hoping you could help me because I get this question a lot when I talk about this and say, you know, we have underbuilt housing. And people say, okay, yeah, if that's been going on, though, for the last 15 years or so, why has it gotten so acute so recently? Because it feels like, yes, this has been a problem developing for a while. But since the pandemic, it seems like it's really just taken on another level of urgency and crises. So what happened then that has led to this acceleration?
Well, I think what you saw, it's now becoming, it used to be a really kind of a coastal problem or big city problem. Then with the pandemic, people started, aha, I don't have to live here and I could move somewhere and work remotely. So then you saw like the explosion of demand in places like Nashville, Tennessee, and Austin, Texas. And, you know, a place that really, because if it's a very attractive place to live, was Montana. A place like Montana, for example. I think about 50,000 people moved in there during the pandemic years, and they didn't have the housing supply to accommodate that. So housing affordability became a major issue in the state of Montana, and Governor Gianforte, who's a Republican governor, put together a task force, diverse group of people representing all points of view. And they came up with a series of bills to reform the land use and zoning issues. So I think what you're seeing now, Dave, is that, you know, prior to the pandemic, housing affordability was a major issue. I mean, if you live like me in D.C. and I come from New York City, other areas, this has always been a big, housing affordability has been a long time problem. But with the pandemic, you saw it becoming a problem in more and more places throughout the country, that Boise, Idaho, for example, that people were not used to. So I think that's part of the problem.
Thank you for explaining that. I just want to add two things and correct me if you disagree here, Dennis. Two things that I want to highlight. One is that you said that earlier that there's a mismatch. So oftentimes, there could be cities that are losing people and losing demand, and there might be, in your particular market, sufficient housing or even an excess of housing. But you see, with these changing migration patterns, like using Boise or Bozeman as examples, like people just started moving there in droves and overwhelmed the housing supply in those particular areas. But I also want to call out that household formation and housing demand is not always a zero-sum game. And demographic trends and some of the things that happened during the pandemic as well have led to just more overall demand, whether it's people not wanting to live with a roommate anymore,
right,
or millennials reaching this quote-unquote peak home buying age, that all these things sort of converged, it seems, to sort of make this simmering problem into like a rapid boil.
That's a great point, Dave. I mean, you have to look at the demand side and household formations, which is, you know, really critical. And you're right. I mean, people, millennials, 20s, 30s, they were breaking up with roommates, maybe getting out of their parents' house finally and saying, okay, I got to step up out on my own. And that put a lot of, you know, demand, particularly in the rental side. There's, you know, a tremendous uptick in demand, which now the market's responding in many communities and, you know, building in response to the demand.
Great. Well, I want to move in a minute, Dennis, to talk about some of the potential solutions and remaining challenges to improving the situation, but just want to extrapolate for a second. Obviously, the people who are rent burdened or can't afford to buy a home right now are individually impacted, and that is probably a very challenging situation. But I'm curious if you can help us sort of extrapolate this out and understand like how the challenges with housing affordability are impacting the American economy and sort of society as a whole.
Yeah, we did a paper you could get on our website, bipartisanpolicy.org, showing that, you know, the lack of access to affordable housing strongly impacts in a negative way labor mobility. People are unable to move to the areas of the country where the jobs are, because housing is so costly, and it is a real drag on overall GDP growth. And the person who we have a paper that kind of summarizes that work on our website, but Edward Glaser, I would highly recommend your viewers checking his work out. He's the chairman of the economics department at Harvard University. He has written extensively about the impact of lack of access to affordable housing, how that negatively impacts the ability of workers to move to where the jobs are, you know, and then that impacts, you know, economic growth. And I've been, you know, anecdotally, I've gone to places around the country, gone to universities, was at a university, I won't say where, and they said that they're having trouble attracting professors or new young professors because they couldn't afford the cost of housing in that particular community. So it has broader macroeconomic implications. And that's what we try to make that point at the BPC, because that's an argument that really both parties should get.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for explaining that. Let's move on to some of the existing solutions and potential solutions out there. So there has been a long-standing tax credit called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit that was created, I think, 35 years ago, something like 30, 35 years ago.
1986. You did the math. Okay. That's what, 37 years ago.
It's 37 because I'm 36, so that was easy for me. 1 year older than I am. But tell us, Dennis, what is the LIHTC and what was it created to help solve?
Okay, it's a tax credit created in 1986, bipartisan, George Mitchell, a Democrat, and Jack Danforth, a Republican from Missouri, were the sort of the authors of this idea. It provides a reduction in tax liability to private investors and developers who put money into rental housing that is income restricted, meaning that it's available to households at a certain lower income level, and also rent restricted. And the program, you know, started off a little slow, but over since 1986, it's been responsible for financing about 3.7 million affordable rental homes.
Wow.
So it's a way of sort of harnessing, attracting, encouraging private sector funding into affordable rental housing, and it has been successful. And it is our most successful affordable rental production program in the United States. And I know at BPC, in terms of solutions, we support expanding the LIHTC, or the Low Income Housing Tax Credit. There's legislation, the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, pending in Congress, that has like 218 or more sponsors evenly divided between both parties. I mean, it's enormously supported by both parties. There is now something going on. Remember the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act, the tax package, child tax credits, and the business expensing, which passed the House earlier this year. which is now stalled in the United States Senate. That has provisions in it that would strengthen the LIHTC and would lead to an estimated 200,000 new affordable rental units over the next 2 years. So we are advocating for that very, very strongly.
Okay, great. Yeah. So let's actually dig into it a little bit. So it just to summarize, it's basically a tax incentive for real estate developers to create affordable housing that has some provisions on it about what it can be rented for. Is that right?
Yeah, it has to be the people who avail themselves of the project, who live in the project have to, or the development, have to have incomes generally below 60% of area and median income. And the rents are also restricted. But the subsidy that's provided makes the math work for developers.
And is it just ubiquitous? Like, can anyone apply for this? Is there a limitation to it? Like, it sounds pretty successful. So what's holding it back?
Yeah, there's authority, tax allocation authority delivered to all 50 states and I believe Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands on an annual basis. It's based on a percentage of per capita for each state gets a certain amount of tax credits that they can utilize. And then these tax credits are states develop something called qualified allocation plans, where they put out the, this is, okay, developer, private, you want to compete for the tax credits, you got to meet the, we set some goals in our qualified allocation plan. This is the state. And then developers apply competitively to get access to the credits. Of course, it costs the federal government money when they, that's why, it's not unlimited program, but the credits are allocated on a per capita basis to the respective states, and then developers compete for the credits through state agencies.
Okay, got it. I wish we have some co-hosts on the show who are developers, and I know two of them, James and Kathy, have tried to build affordable housing with mixed success, and so I'm just curious, like, is this easy for developers to do, or is this sort of an extra hurdle? Is it cost intensive for them to try and apply for these funds?
I think people who have been doing it for a while have find it relatively straightforward, but if you're doing it for the first time, it's probably a bit more complicated and potentially a bit more mystifying. The program's been around for 36, 37 years, just 1 year older than you, I think, Dave. it's got a rhythm that people in the community really understand how it works.
We do have to take one more quick break to hear a word from our sponsors, but stick around because we have more from Dennis when we come back.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb? And that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the show. Now, you also mentioned before the AHCIA. You in Washington, you guys love your acronyms.
I know.
But it's the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that would offer?
That would essentially increase the allocations to the states by about 50% and make other adjustments in the program that would make it more more accessible and extend the utilization of the credits. So it's basically a 50% bump up in allocation in spending for the program.
Okay, so just similar program, just expanding it, doing
a few other important changes, but that's essentially it.
And would this 50% increase meet the need for affordable housing, or how far would it get us?
It's estimated that over 10 years, it would create 2 million new affordable rental homes.
Wow.
Additional. So it would be significant, but there's no one answer to this problem. And it's not just going to be a federal government solution. Local cities, states need to take action. Many are taking action. But if the ACHIA passed in Congress, that would be significant, about 2 million homes over the next 10 years. It's also something called the Neighborhood Homes Investment Act, which is a similar program modeled after the LIHTC, after the low-income housing tax credit, which would incentivize private investment in starter homes for sale in distressed communities. And that would be an estimated 500,000 new homes over the next 10 years. So if you combine both, that's 2.5 million over 10. That's not going to solve the problem. But it's, these are important actions that could be taken to help close the gap.
Absolutely. But, are there any other policies or ideas that either you're working on or you've heard of that you think could additionally help close the gap?
Yes, there are programs out there. One thing that the federal government could do would be to incentivize local communities to reform their zoning and land use policies to allow greater density and more diversity in housing types. So that is something that we have supported at the BPC. Sort of incentive approaches.
And Dennis, I'm just going to, let me just interject here just to make sure everyone understands. A lot of municipalities have very rigid and specific zoning codes, which means that, for example, you might be in a neighborhood or a city where you can only build single family homes. And even if developers want to build multifamily, which is more efficient and more cost effective to build, or the community really needs it, sometimes they can't do that because of these restrictive zoning. And so I think what Dennis, just correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're saying is perhaps cities can be incentivized to change those zoning to allow for higher density, meaning rather than having a single family home on every plot, maybe you have a duplex, triplex, quadplex, so we can get more houses into the same amount of space.
Exactly. And there are other things like parking minimums, which can be reduced potentially, and permitting reform, where if you follow certain requirements, you get the permit as of right, as opposed to having to go through other sorts of processes, and which add cost to building. So yes, that's a great summary, Dave, on the zoning. So we have an advisory committee at the Terwilliger Center, and two of our members are Henry Cisneros, who's the former Secretary of HUD in the Clinton administration, and Steve Stivers, who is the former Republican ranking member of the Housing Subcommittee. He's now the CEO of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. They recently wrote an op-ed for Newsweek saying, let's use some of the appropriated but unobligated COVID relief funds to support the production of affordable housing in good locations. And let's waive, at the federal level, waive a lot of regulations. And at the local level, communities who want access to these funds have to make reforms. So that was an idea that we estimated tens of billions of dollars in appropriated but unobligated COVID relief funds. And if 10% of that were used to help affordable housing, help produce more housing in good locations, that would be a worthwhile use. But that's something that they've advocated.
Now, Dennis, I want to ask you one more question. This show is primarily, our audience is primarily real estate investors, real estate agents, people who work in the investing industry. And over the last few years, I've at least commonly heard that investors are at least partially to blame for the affordable housing issues in this country. So I'm curious, your honest opinion, do you think that's true? And or what sort of just more broadly, what role do investors play in the affordable housing issue?
I personally don't ascribe to that view. I know others have concerns about the acquisition of housing by institutional investors or private firms. I don't personally have that view. I mean, we need more. My view is we need more private investment in housing in the United States. It cannot be the government exclusively building homes, financing homes. So I don't share that. Share that point of view. And if you look at some of the statistics I've seen, there are other things that are causing the housing affordability problem, generally a lack of supply, building being the primary culprit.
Got it. Okay. And so if your belief is that investors in private investment can help alleviate the affordable housing issue, is there anywhere our audience could learn more about what they could do to help build affordable housing if they're so interested?
I would recommend you come to our website, bipartisanpolicy.org, bipartisanpolicy.org. We have a lot of good material and content on our website that's fortunately digestible. We don't overwhelm you with 20, 30-page papers. We give you good lists. So, for example, this may not apply to private investors, but we have like 10 actions that cities could take to increase housing supply. And it lists 10 things, 5 actions that states can take that would increase housing supply. We have primers on the low-income housing tax credit that take this ostensibly complicated program and explain it quite succinctly, and I think in a way that's easily accessible to people.
All right. Well, Dennis, thank you so much for joining us and educating us on this really important issue. We appreciate your time.
Dave, great to be with you. Thank you.
Another big thanks to Dennis for joining us, and thank you all for listening. This is a really important topic. At least I think that affordable housing is an issue that investors should be thinking about. Obviously, as Dennis noted, that this impacts our entire economy, not just in the housing sector, but does impact jobs, local communities, and of course, it impacts the individuals who are increasingly rent burdened or having trouble affording their own home. And I just want to remind people that most of the data, most of the policy suggests that there is mutual benefit here. And by creating more affordable housing, it's not going to negatively impact real estate investors or those in our industry. So if you are interested in learning more about this, definitely check out the show notes and Dennis's work. And I also encourage you to see what your local government is doing, what your local municipality is doing, and if there's any ways, if you're so interested, to get involved in creating affordable housing in your own community. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For On the Market, for Bigger Pockets, I'm Dave Meyer, and I'll see you guys soon.
On the Market was created by me, Dave Meyer, and Kalen Bennett. The show is produced by Kalen Bennett with editing by Exodus Media. Copywriting is by Calico Content, and we want to extend a big thank you to everyone at Bigger Pockets for making this show possible.
The market is changing. Finding your way can be tricky. Rates shift, headlines whirl, but your goal hasn't changed. You want financial freedom. And the best investors know it's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. If you're ready to get into the real estate investing game or take your game to the next level, finding an investor-friendly agent is your next step. With BiggerPockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in minutes. Just head to biggerpockets.com/deals. Enter a few details about what and where you want to buy, and boom, instantly match with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own. Investments in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose. Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.